Didn't everybody go to Hawaii over the break? I know that feeling. Good. Well, on the downward side of the semester, 4 weeks to go. And everybody's ready. Rested up. Right? Come on now, that's what breaks are for. Get rested up. You're not supposed to close down the sanctuary every night, you know? I vowed I wasn't going to do that last night, and I did it anyway. Told my wife, I said, look, we got to leave early. We can't close down the place tonight. There he was at midnight, picking up the kids. That's right, thank you. That's right, we didn't pass out the rule book last Friday, the last time we met. So, sign twice if you were here. If you weren't here, then don't sign in there. Okay. Now we have set the date for the test, is that right, Friday? This coming Friday, on chapters 21 through 30. There'll be one other test besides that over the individual chapters. That'll be over 31 through 52, which we're going to cover rapidly anyway, so it's not a big test. I still haven't decided on the final. It depends on whether we have time. Okay, and the final's a little bigger. So it's about four times the size of your regular tests. But the regular ones are only a page or two, you know, three. So don't feel bad about it. Okay, Jeremiah chapter 33. We left off in verse 24. We've been talking in verse 22 about the fulfillment of the covenant to Abraham being spoken of there. And in verse 24 here it says, "Considerest thou..." I'll start from verse 23. "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, saying, Considerest thou not what this people have spoken, saying, The two families which the Lord hath chosen, he hath even cast them off. Thus they have despised my people, that they should be no more a nation before them." Now, this people, the ones who are speaking, is the wicked Jews. And they're speaking and saying, The two families which the Lord hath chosen, he hath even cast them off. The two families represent Judah and Israel. Okay? In other words, he's telling Jeremiah, don't listen to them when they say this. These are the wicked Jews. And saying, thus they have despised my people, that they should be no more before them. This is what God has said, not what the wicked Jews have said. He says, thus have they despised my people. In other words, he's contrasting here. Those that he's calling this people have spoken, saying, okay, is different than my people. They have despised my people in saying this. Now, who is my people? That is the righteous Jews. Those who are righteous in there. And spiritual Israel in that sense. Saying God has cast them off. God has cast them off. That's what it was said to Job. You know, his comforters came. God has cast you off because of your sin. You know, and thus they despised him, and they despised God in doing so. They were saying God was unrighteous. Verse 25, "Thus saith the Lord, if my covenant be not with day and night, and if I have not appointed the ordinances of heaven and earth, then will I cast away the seed of Jacob and David my servant, so that I will not take any of his seed to be rulers over the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, for I will cause their captivity to return and have mercy on them." Now God is saying that as long as he will keep his covenant with nature, that he will keep his covenant with his people. So both are absolutely sure. In other words, God sets things in motion. He's not going to alter that. He's not going to change those things in motion. He's not going to change the covenant that he made with them. In other words, the sun's going to continue to rise. And the moon, and all the rest of the ordinances of God that he set in motion in this heaven and earth, as long as it exists, they're going to continue. He's not going to change them. And that's how sure it is that they will have a ruler over them. That's how sure it is that there will be a seed of Jacob existing. That's because of the promise that was given to Abraham. It's not because of how good they were. It is so that God's name should not be blasphemed in the earth anymore. In other words, that he would be vindicated in his people. Now, in the process, he's pulling the righteous out of that nation and drawing them to himself. But in reality, it's for his name to be honored and glorified. That's the whole purpose. All things are created for his pleasure. Yeah, for his glory and his honor. Now, it is a most wonderful blessing that in the process we get to be honored and glorified and we have all the blessings of God, because that's his very nature. But in reality, it's for his name, for him to be glorified properly, for his heart to be satisfied, for his pleasure. Just so happens that because of the nature, not just so happens, it's just that his nature is such that we will be blessed and glorified and honored and pleased and delighted and overjoyed and, you know, joy unspeakable and full of glory. That's because of who he is. But it's for his honor and his glory. Chapter 34. That's why we're here. That's really why we're here. For his honor and his glory. You know, if we can keep that, that's part of that vision that was spoken about yesterday. That's that big, grand vision that's been written for us. That it's for his glory. And if we keep that in view, it'll make our struggles a little less. I mean, we'll recognize it'll be difficult at times, but we'll recognize also that it's for his glory. All the things that he's doing is for his glory. Now, in the process, he's changing us and he's going to glorify us because that glorifies him. But it's for him. That will help us to keep our eyes off the temporal situations, the temporary things that are happening to us now. It'll keep our eyes off those things. Instead of being focused on them, we'll be focused on Jesus and what he wants to do for eternity, and that he should be honored and glorified. That has been I've set myself, and God has blessed me and blessed me and blessed me, because that has been my heart, to set myself for his honor and his glory. Back praying, just, you know, seeking God, saying, I want holiness, I want purity, I want to honor you and glorify you that way. That's why I want to be holy and pure, to honor him and to glorify him. And when I pray that, boy, he just comes down and blesses me. He does. He blesses me. I was crying out, you know, I mean, in this move, I don't have all the answers. In fact, I don't know anybody that has all the answers. You know, and there's things that I have questioned. I mean, my middle shelf, like somebody says, is getting heavy. I mean, it's getting big. It's a big, big middle shelf. And I just take it and say, Lord Jesus, you know what my heart is. My heart is, I want holiness and purity and righteousness. I want you. And I was praying and praying and praying and just beseeching God for holiness in my life. And it's like he spoke to my heart and he said, become love. You want to be holy? Become love. Because that's what I am. Be ye holy as I am holy. All right, become love. That's what I am. That's my nature. You'll be holy. That's right. Boy, it was just kind of like, thank you, Jesus, you know. I mean, it doesn't justify anything that I do in this move, but at least he's saying to my heart, you're manifesting my heart of love, and you're becoming love because of it. And he's not saying you're perfect in everything that you've ever done or everything that you think. But your heart is right before me, and you just become love. I'll show you how to become love. You'll be holy. You'll keep it holy. You'll keep it pure. You know, I mean, it's not like I won't slam the guardrails every now and then or something, you know. But God will keep me, because that's what my heart is before him. Anyway, verse 34. That's what we're here for him to be glorified. The word which came unto Jeremiah from the Lord. When Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army, and all the kingdoms of the earth, and of his dominions, and of the people, fought against Jerusalem, saying, all the cities against Jerusalem, and against all the cities thereof, saying, my contacts must be in upside down or something. I'm in trouble reading. I forgot how to read over the break, I think. We have here the same time element as we see in chapter 32, verses 1 through 5. Okay? And so Nebuchadnezzar has come up. Thus saith the Lord. Now verses 2 through 5 here are going to show that Zedekiah will die in peace in Babylon. Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, go and speak to Zedekiah, king of Judah, and tell him, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will give this city into the hand of the king of the Babylon, and he shall burn it with fire. And thou shalt not escape out of his hand. but shalt surely be taken and delivered into his hand, and thine eyes shall behold the eyes of the king of Babylon, and he shall speak with thee mouth to mouth, and thou shalt go to Babylon. Now, as we see in chapter 52, verses 9 through 11, this is what happened. And then they took the king and carried him up into the king of Babylon to Riblah in the land of Hamath, where he gave judgment upon him. And the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and he slew also the princes of Judah in Riblah. Now he said he would see him face to face. He would see him. And so he's seeing him. What's he seeing him do? Kill his own sons. Then he put out the eyes of Zedekiah. And the king of Babylon bound him in chains and carried him to Babylon and put him in prison till the day of his death. He didn't say he'd see Babylon. He said he'd see the king. And then he would be carried away to Babylon. And they put out his eyes. You might also compare Ezekiel chapter 12, verses 6, 12, and 13. Now, he didn't have the same end as Jehoiakim, because he wasn't as wicked. As we're going to see about Zedekiah, he was kind of a waffler, you know. He never really came down solid on one side or the other. He was a compromiser. And sometimes he would do things that were right, and sometimes he wouldn't, depending upon how he was swayed by his counselors. And so he didn't have a real strong heart and commitment, which is a bad thing, but it's better than having a strong heart and commitment like Jehoiakim did, and that was to do wickedness. So his end is not quite so severe as Jehoiakim's, and he's going to die in peace. And verses 3 through 7, verses 4 through 7 rather, "Yet hear the word of the Lord, O Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus saith the Lord of thee, thou shalt not die by the sword, but thou shalt die in peace. And with the burnings of thy fathers, the former kings which were before thee, so shall they burn odors for thee. And they will lament thee, saying, Ah, Lord, for I have pronounced the word, saith the Lord. Then Jeremiah the prophet spake all these words unto Zedekiah, king of Judah, in Jerusalem. When the king of Babylon's army fought against Jerusalem and against all the cities of Judah that were left, against Lachish and against Azekah, for these defense cities remained of the cities of Judah." Now, this is showing this Lachish and Azekah, these were defense cities that were built by Rehoboam. We see in 2 Chronicles chapter 11, 2 Chronicles 11, verses 5 and 9. But it shows here that Nebuchadnezzar's campaign was well advanced, since these two are the only fortified towns remaining. And so he's taken the rest. Now, letters discovered from Lachish show Azekah had fallen, and Lachish was about to be destroyed. So there were some letters that have been discovered that indicate this. Now, both were destroyed in 587 B.C. And so we have a date, approximate date for this, because of it. They were destroyed about the same time. We have archaeological facts that support that Lachish and Azekah were the last remaining towns. Verses 8 and 9. "And this is the word that came unto Jeremiah from the Lord, after that the king Zedekiah had made a covenant with all the people which were at Jerusalem, to proclaim liberty unto them, that every man should let his manservant, and every man his maidservant, being in Hebrew or in Hebrews, to go free, that none should serve him of them, to wit, of a Jew, his brother." Now, they're letting him go free because of the siege. Now, there's probably several things going on here. First of all, under the siege, there wasn't a lot of food. So, they couldn't afford to feed the slaves. They couldn't afford to feed the servants. And so this would look like a good thing that they're doing, but probably motive was partly that they couldn't afford or didn't want to afford to feed these same servants, and so they released them. Second of all, it would be an external righteous act. Now we've released these servants, you know. We're being good. We're being, you know, proper. Now King Zedekiah had asked them to do this, probably as a righteous act to fulfill part of the covenant. As we'll see, God says it was part of the covenant. And so it was probably done also as a righteous act. You know, somehow to appease God, somehow to hopefully allow him or give him some cause to save the city, you know, because we are righteous, you know. Now what happened, though, was that when the siege was interrupted by Pharaoh Hophra, he came up from Egypt. Nebuchadnezzar and his armies were drawn off. They had to go and fight Egypt for a while. And so the siege on the city stopped for a while. When they did that, they brought the servants back under bondage again, even though they'd released them. See this in verse 11. Now, what happened in that situation then was, well, see, God did deliver the city. We didn't have to let go of the servants after all. And so they took them back and forced them to be servants again. They reverted their old lifestyle. In other words, they were very dull and short-sighted in their vision. They couldn't see what was really happening. Now, when all the princes, this is verse 10, and all the people which had entered into the covenant heard that everyone should let his manservant and everyone his maidservant go free, that none should serve themselves of them anymore, then they obeyed and let them go. But afterward, they turned and caused the servants and the handmaids whom they had let go free to return and brought them into subjection for servants and for handmaids. Therefore, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, so God is going to speak about this now. Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, I made a covenant with your fathers in the day that I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondmen, saying, in other words, I released them as being bondmen, and so I made a covenant with them when they were bondmen. He's bringing them back to where they were. You were bondmen, all of you. At the end of 7 years, let ye go every man his brother and Hebrew, which hath been sold unto thee. And when he hath served thee 6 years, thou shalt let go free from thee. But your fathers hearkened not unto me, neither inclined their ear. Now this is referring to Exodus chapter 21, verse 2. And it's not to be confused with the year of Jubilee. The year of Jubilee is where they released all the debts, the land was restored to the rightful owners. You know, in other words, if somebody was in a bad way or for some reason they sold their land, they didn't lose their birthright to that land because in the year of Jubilee it was to be returned to them free of charge, no matter what the debt had been. Now, of course, they always figured it out, you know, if you sell the land and it's worth, if the land's worth $50 and you sell the land in the 48th year, then you're only going to get $2 for the land, see, because it's only, in other words, they prorated the whole thing. So it's not like they lost a lot in the process, but it was returned to them so they wouldn't lose their birthright. And now ye were now turned and had done right in my sight in proclaiming liberty every man to his neighbor. And ye had made a covenant before me in the house which is called by my name. So they did it. But ye turned and polluted my name and caused every man his servant and every man his handmaid whom he had set at liberty at their pleasure to return and brought them into subjection to be unto you for servants and for handmaids. Therefore thus saith the Lord, ye have not hearkened unto me in proclaiming liberty every one to his brother, and every man to his neighbor. Behold, I proclaim a liberty for you, saith the Lord, to the sword, to the pestilence, and to the famine, and I will make you to be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth. This is what your liberty will be. This is what your liberty will be. They had turned. God is looking at any opportunity. See, they turned at first and did a right thing. And God said that was a good thing. And he was pleased with it. But then they turned. He was willing to look at that simple act of obedience and commend them for it. But they turned. Even in that simple thing, they turned. And so what are they going to get? Liberty. They're going to get liberty. They're going to get set free so that the sword can have them, and pestilence and famine, and to be removed to all the kingdoms of the earth. Paul?
You said that did not refer to the year of Jubilee?
No.
That was the standard 7-year.
Yeah, every seventh year. Now, I didn't read Exodus 21:2, and I'm not sure whether it was that. It may not have been, this is the seventh year, and then all were released. It may be that they were only allowed to serve a maximum of 6 years, and in the seventh year they would be released. So I'm not real clear on that one. I should look into that. But the year of Jubilee only came every 50th year. So, so this is ironic what he's saying here. God's going to give them the freedom that they denied to others. They're going to be no longer under his service and no longer under his protection. You are my servants, and so I'm going to give you freedom. You know, that's like people that fight and kick, you know, and they end up leaving the assembly. You know, they end up getting put out of the assembly. They're rebellious and they get put out of the assembly. And they proclaim that now they have liberty. Now I'm free. I've heard this. About 5 years ago, or 4 years ago, there was a certain number of articles. Maybe it was 5 years ago in the paper. And there were some that were proclaiming they were glad to be free of this place. You know, they were glad that they were free, that they weren't bound by this place anymore. I'll tell you what kind of liberty they walked into. Sword, pestilence, famine, and to be taken into every nation and the kings and nations of the earth. That's where they're living. I know. I have a neighbor who lives right behind me who left as part of the dissidents. He was put out of the church. I didn't know it when we first moved in there. And one day I got taught, he was so glad to be free, you know, and just out from underneath that bondage and everything. So that he could listen to his rock music at 450 decibels, you know, get himself in trouble with the neighbors because they finally called the police. He ended up going to jail. Shows you what kind of attitude it was. He wanted to play his rock music however he wanted to play it. He could only play it loud. Now, it was Christian rock, though, of course. I mean, I'd go out and mow my lawn, and I'd hear weird things in there, things like cross, you know, just screamed out, you know, kind of things. And it's really weird, you know. Then I heard Keith Green one time. Now, he was a lot softer than that. I don't know if you know Keith Green. And I thought, now that's really strange that he would have that in there, you know. Maybe it's Christian. I'd never heard Christian rock before. I didn't know anything about it. But anyway, he got in trouble. They called the police because he was just rebellious, and he told the neighbors he wasn't going to turn it down. He was going to listen to it the way he wanted to, period. You know? So they called the police. The police came out. He got belligerent with the police. Now this is the fruit. This is the liberty that he stepped into. He had a motorcycle sitting out front. He left the key in it. That's illegal to do. Now nobody has ever gotten a ticket for it. They arrested him for it. Why? Because he got belligerent with them. Rebellious. That's the kind of liberty he was living in. Not much freedom to me. I talked to him after that. I didn't know he was from the chapel at the time, or had been here. And certain things happened, but that's the kind of liberty he had. He still lives there, as far as I know, and I rarely see him. Doesn't play his rock music quite as loud anymore. But that's liberty. That's liberty. You know, liberty, that's what the world has out there. They are free to sin any way they want and get themselves so totally bound by the devil, there's no hope for them. Kind of liberty that the Gadarene demoniac had, you know. He was free. I mean, he could run around naked, live in the caves. Yeah, he was free. That's the kind of freedom they were going to be released to. Verse 18, and I will give the men that have transgressed my covenant, which have not performed the words of the covenant, which they had made before me when they cut the calf in twain and passed between the parts thereof. Said, I will give the men that have the princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem and the eunuchs and the priests and all the people of the land which passed between the parts of the calf, and I will even give them into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of them that seek their life, and their dead bodies shall be meat unto the fowls of heaven and unto the beasts of the earth. Now they felt no shame at breaking the covenant. No shame. They just transgressed it however they wanted. They walked between the parts of the calf. In other words, remember the cutting of the covenant? It was a very graphic thing when they cut the covenant. They took the animals, they cut them in half, laid half on either side, and they walked between. The point of it was, this is me. If I don't fulfill my part of the covenant, to be separated that way. Probably a pretty ugly thing to look at. Very bloody. But they had no shame. They just broke it. Didn't matter. You can compare Genesis chapter 15, verses 10 and 17. This is where Abraham cut the covenant with God. And this is what he did. Also Matthew chapter 24, 51. That was Genesis 15, 10 through 7, 10 and 17. Matthew 24:51. Now, verses 19 through 22 show the consequences of breaking the covenant. Verse 21, "And Zedekiah, king of Judah, and his princes will I give into the hand of their enemies, and into the hand of them that seek their life, and into the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which are gone up from you." In other words, they're gone up from you, but I'm going to give you into their hand anyway. "Behold, I will command, saith the Lord, and cause them to return to this city, and they shall fight against it, and take it, and burn it with fire, and I will make the cities of Judah a desolation without an inhabitant." That's the same thing he told them before. It's just that now they think they've gotten deliverance. Aha! Hezekiah's deliverance has come unto us. Babylon has gone up. He said, "I'll make them to return." We're going to see even farther. Chapter 35. Now this is the rebuke against the unbelief of Judah, and it's using the example of the Rechabites. Now the Rechabites are a real interesting group. You don't hear much about them, but this is one of the places you hear about them. Verse 1. "The word which came unto Jeremiah from the Lord in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, Go into the house of the Rechabites and speak unto them, and bring them into the house of the Lord, into one of the chambers, and give them wine to drink." Now, this is at the time of Jehoiakim. So, chronologically, we have gone back again about 17 years. This is before the siege. But they're under the threat of Nebuchadnezzar at this time. Now, what this is showing is that God gave them an example beforehand. That's why it's coming here at this point. God showed them an example beforehand of obedience. And because of that, and he shows that God was willing to deal mercifully with them before punishing them. But they're not going to listen. But here's an example. See, God always has a testimony. He always has a witness. He always has a witness. Always. Verse 2, we read, "Now the Rechabites were a nomadic tribe that belonged to the Kenites of Hemath." 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 55. "Now they were of the family of Jethro." That's where the Kenites came from. Now you remember who Jethro is? Another name for him is Hobab. That was Moses' father-in-law. He was a priest of the Midianites, remember? Exodus chapter 18, verse 9. And Numbers chapter 10, verse 29 through 32. They were Midianites, but they were linked up with Israel. Yet they were not Israelites. Now they were allowed to come into the land. If you study out the Kenites, you find that they were allowed to live in the land because they were part of the family, in a sense, because Moses married Jethro's daughter. And they walked with God. They were a good group. Jael, if you remember Jael, who put the spike through the head of Sisera, Jael was of the Kenites. She was married to a Kenite man. Okay? They inhabited the wilderness that was south of Judah. Now, what it says here is, "Give them wine to drink." Now, is this God tempting them to do evil? Well, no, obviously not. James chapter 1, verse 13 says that God is neither tempted of evil nor tempts anyone with evil. Okay, so he's not tempting. Now, this was an acceptable wine to all those who were living for God. In other words, it wasn't unusual. They drank wine at that time, and some of it had some alcoholic content, although when you study it out, you find that the choicest wine was the one that was not, because it had not been sitting so long, hadn't been sitting long enough to ferment. And because when it had sat long enough to ferment, it started getting, you know, bitter and sharp. Frankly, I don't know how people drink wine. I like grape juice. I mean, grape juice is great. Wine, I mean, it's like beer. My father drank, enough beer for the nation. Anyway, he was an alcoholic. But I couldn't stand the stuff. I thought, why do people drink this stuff? Why? Some people actually like the taste, too. I thought, it's Like people like the taste of cigarettes. Oh, no. You have to be crazy. Really. Demonized. That's it. But anyway, best wine was the straight, sweet grape juice, fresh pressed, you know. And as it got older and began to ferment, they would dilute it because to dilute the bitterness and the other things. You know, they had certain ways that they preserved it to some degree. And so, but it did have some alcoholic content. But see, God never said that alcohol was intrinsically evil. He said, "Be not drunk with wine, wherein is excess." Now today we don't drink it because of just the whole connotations surrounding it. They drank it because that was all they had to drink. That was either that or brackish warm water. You know, so they was, you know, how many of us would like to drink warm milk or warm brackish water or have a little bit of wine? See, the choice is a pretty limited choice. I mean, you couldn't go down to the store and buy some Kool-Aid, you know, and mix it up with water and ice and, you know, or lemon. It just didn't have those things. And so this they drank. Well, now we don't do it because it's just the connotations with it. We don't have to drink it, so why bother? You know? Anyway. Now, so this was acceptable except for those of a special vow. Now, what we're going to find is the Rechabites had a special vow. Now, Jeremiah may not have known about the vow that the Rechabites had. He may not have known why he was making this offer of wine to them. He may not have understood this at all. Now, God used it as a test. But was it really God testing man to do evil? No. God set this test, but who tempted to do evil? See, who tempts to do evil? Only the devil is the one who tempts to do evil. God tries us and proves us, but he never tempts us to do evil. The devil does that. Actually, it says in James that every man is tempted of his own lusts and enticed by his own lusts. That is his strong cravings and strong desires. Now, no, those are not necessarily wrong. Lusts, in and of themselves, are not intrinsically evil. Because that's what it says. Because it says, when lust hath conceived, then it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it's finished, brings forth death. So the strong cravings are not wrong. That's the thing we have to recognize. This is the thing the devil likes to bring. Particularly in this move. Start thinking certain things. Your body reacts a certain way, or thoughts go through your mind. It's what you do with it. It's when lust has conceived that you have sinned. Otherwise, it's just temptation, and temptation isn't sin. Now, the devil just loves to come. Particularly if we have a legalistic bent. And we have set the line of when temptation is sin. We've set the line, not God. But we set the line in our own mind when we've sinned. And so the devil comes along and says, "Look at that, cross the line. You sinned." Puts fear. Why? Because we want holiness, we want righteousness, we want purity in our life. We don't want to sin. So we're afraid. You know, the devil puts the thoughts in the mind, takes what are normal or natural responses, and pushes them and promotes them and puts them in thought, certain thoughts into your mind, and what happens? Fear. I don't want to touch that. So we draw back in fear. All the time, it's the devil who's just tempting, and he's got his buffaloed into thinking that temptation is sin. That's what you do with the temptation. It's when you say, "No, I won't have any part of that. I've committed against that. I am totally set against those kind of things. And, you know, I don't even want those thoughts in my head. I don't want those things. I want Jesus." You can walk free then. He can come and tempt 24 hours a day, you know, 60 seconds, every second. There's new temptation. He can tempt all he wants. You're set. You're free. You walk free. You don't have to listen to his condemnation. Anyway, that's free. But the devil is the one who tempts. See, God set two trees in Eden. Now, it was a test to have those two trees in Eden. But he did not tempt them. The devil tempted. So, we come up against situations. We can choose one or the other. One may be evil and the other may be good. God is not tempting us. Every man is tempted of his own lusts. See? It's a test. It's to see, will you choose the right way? But he doesn't tempt. The devil comes and brings the temptation. And not only that, but with the test, God always makes a way of escape, no matter what. See, this is the thing. God always makes a way of escape. And that way of escape is always the truth. It's following the truth. It's following through on our vows and our commitments to God. that were made previously in the power of God. And that's how we overcome temptation, in the power of God. Really. No temptation has come upon you such as common unto man. And with the temptation or the trial will come the power, a way of escape for you. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, paraphrased a little bit.
What's really the difference between God proving us, i.e. putting us in a place where we can either walk with Him or sin, or tempt Him, versus God tempteth no man? Like with Christ trying to be in the wilderness, pushing Him out there where He couldn't tempt Him.
In the situation, there's two different kinds of proving, basically. There's a kind of proving where there's a way of proving something that is proving whether it's strong or not strong. It's like putting in the furnace, you know, the gold. You know, that's proving the gold, is what it does. In other words, it forces things to the surface. You get rid of those. It clarifies and purifies the gold. Now, that is not necessarily that's not temptation at all. In other words, all it's doing is pointing up these things, and that's the kind of proving that God does. In other words, He puts us in a certain situation that forces issues. Okay. But the temptation that comes to us is not God tempting us. It's Him allowing the devil to tempt us with things. So in a sense, he's almost always using the devil to prove us. There are situations, more positive kind of things. You know, will you grow stronger, or will you keep walking the way you are? Which are not necessarily temptations to sin one way or another. It's just making choices. It's like Jesus in the garden. He was not being tempted to sin in the garden, but He was being proven. Okay? Because He could have chosen the other way. He could have chosen and said, I'm not going to drink of this cup, Father. I don't have to drink of this cup. He didn't. He didn't have to drink of it. Not for His own salvation. It would not have been sin. It would not have been sin for Him to not drink of that cup, because He was righteous. He'd walked perfect and pure and righteous. He did not have to take the sin of the world upon Himself. He did not. See? So He was being proven there without being tempted to sin. Okay, so there's a distinction there. When the temptation comes, the tempter is the devil. That we know, that's one of his names, the tempter. You know, our adversary, Satan, Satan, that's what Satan means in Hebrew. It means adversary. One who's against us, set against us. So there is a proving that doesn't necessarily involve a temptation to sin, okay? And so that would be the distinction there. Verse 3. Then I took Jaazaniah, the son of Jeremiah, the son of Habazaniah, and his brethren and all his sons, and the whole house of the Rechabites. And I brought them into the house of the Lord, into the chamber of the sons of Hanan, the sons of Igdaliah, a man of God, which was by the chamber of the princes, which was above the chamber of Maaseiah, the son of Shalom, the keeper of the door. Now Jaazaniah means Yahweh hears. And Jeremiah means Yahweh exalts. And Habazaniah means Yahweh gathers. So Yahweh hears, Yahweh exalts, and Yahweh gathers. Now these would have been probably proselytes to Judaism. In fact, they had to be. Otherwise, they could not have been brought into the temple. They were not Israelites, but they had to be proselytes to Judaism. Else they were not allowed into the temple. Now, the chamber here in the temple, this is Solomon's temple, and apparently it had apartments, so to speak, adjoining it for residents, of priests, for offerings, for vessels to be placed. You know, it was quite a large complex, apart from the actual holy place and holy of holies, you know, and the different courts. There were apparently attached a number of apartments and courtyards and Solomon's porch. Is that what it's called? Yeah, Solomon's porch. That's it. I'm going to say colonnade, but that's not right. And this is the way Ezekiel's temple is also. It's apparently got a number of different rooms around. Quite interesting to try and figure out what they all are. But anyway, so they were sent around there, and that's where he took them into him. And he took them to a place where there was a good man of God. It was his apartment, or the chamber, where he stayed, or that was set aside for him. Verse 5. And I set before the sons of the house of the Rechabites pots full of wine and cups, and said unto them, drink ye wine. In other words, he's doing just what the Lord said to him. Now, this is a test. Like we said, though, Jeremiah may not have known that it was a test, although I suspect that he did. He suspected something was up. I mean, he knew that God wouldn't just tell him, oh, give him wine, you know, take him into this special place and give him wine. It's a test. It reminds us of the test of the old prophet in 1 Kings chapter 13. Remember the young prophet went, prophesied a certain thing. God told the young prophet, do not stay in this country, do not eat, do not turn back your foot, but go and leave. The old prophet came up to him and said, come and eat with me. And he said, no, God has told me I can't do that. And he said, oh, I'm a prophet of God also, and God has told me that you are to come and eat at my house. But he lied. It was a test. Who will you believe? Who will you believe? Now, here's a prophet of God, Jeremiah. Eat, drink wine. Drink wine. It's a test. What's their answer? But they said, we will not drink no wine. For Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, ye shall drink no wine, neither ye nor your sons, forever. Now they looked unto Jonadab as the founder. He lived during the reign of Jehu. And he helped Jehu remove the Baal worship. You see that in 2 Kings chapter 10, verses 15 and 23. And they had remained faithful to his injunction to not drink wine over 200 years. This is 200 years later, and they remained faithful. They heard and obeyed their earthly father. That was their earthly father. And they heard him and they obeyed him. And yet, Israel would not even hear their own God. Verse 8, thus we have obeyed the voice of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, in all that he hath charged us, to drink no wine all our days, as we our wives, our sons, nor our daughters. So they obeyed. Now read, skip down to verses 12 through 14. Then came the word of the Lord unto Jeremiah, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, go and tell the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, will ye not receive instruction to hearken to my words? The words of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, that he commanded his sons not to drink wine, are performed. For unto this day they drink none, but obey their father's commandment. Notwithstanding, I have spoken unto you, rising early and speaking, but ye hearken not unto me. These of Jonadab, of Rechab, had responded to Jonadab and his injunction. Now, Jonadab means Yahweh makes freely willing. Yahweh makes freely willing. Fits right perfectly with Philippians chapter 2, verse 13. For it is God who worketh in you both to will and to do of his good pleasure. God makes freely willing. How? You say, Lord, I want to be willing. He'll make you willing. You say, okay, I'll give my heart to you. I'll give my will to you. You help me. He'll make you willing. He'll bring you to a place of willingness. Why? Because you want it. He won't do it if you don't want it. He will not do it if you don't want it, because that violates the free will. And so these were freely willing. They followed after the one that was freely willing before God. Verses 16 through 19. Because the sons of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, have performed the commandment of their father, which he commanded them, but this people hath not hearkened unto me. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will bring upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem all the evil that I pronounced against them, because I have spoken unto them, but they have not heard. And I have called to them, but they have not answered. So here was another example. See, we've been seeing him bring up example after example to them. Here is a people that were not even true Israelites in the blood sense. Not even sons of Abraham. That's not true. Midian was a son of, what was it, Kohath? Was that her name? I think so. I think so. They might have been sons of Abraham in that sense, but they were not. They were not sons of Israel. They are not the children of Israel. And so they were not part of that covenant that was given unto Israel. And yet they obeyed. They obeyed. They obeyed even their earthly father, and they were proselytes to Judaism besides. And he said, look, these, you don't even count as being part of your blood lineage. And they obey me, but you won't obey me. Therefore, you're going to be punished. And Jeremiah said unto the house of the Rechabites, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, because ye have obeyed the commandment of Jonadab your father, and kept all his precepts, and done according to unto all that he hath commanded you, therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Jonadab the son of Rechab shall not want a man to stand before me forever. People of this lineage and obedience will always have a place before God. That's what he's saying. God is covenanted with people of faith. That's what this, you know, that's what we see in the New Testament. The revelation is that a man shall be justified by faith, and that alone. So it says in Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4, this is even the Old Testament. This was the truth in the Old Testament that they didn't receive. Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. That's how he lived. That's why Jonadab and the sons of Jonadab and the Rechabites, why they would be honored. Because they lived by faith. They walked by faith and obedience. Chapter 36. It's the way it's always been that way. What they never saw was that the covenant that was set before them, the Levitical ordinances that was given unto them, were established only by faith. They had value only in faith. Apart from faith, they had no value. And God came to them and told them, your offerings and sacrifices are a din. They're a stench in my nostrils. Away with them. I said, wait a minute, you're the one that commanded them. No, I commanded faith. I commanded faith. And these ordinances are to be fulfilled in faith. And if they're not, then they're... You know, it's like having all the gifts and all the power, but not having love. It's like a sounding, clanging, clattering cymbal. Discordant. Doesn't fit.
Do you have any comment on the Rechabites not wanting a man to sit on their throne?
Well, it doesn't say a throne. It says, he shall not want a man to stand before me forever. In other words, they will always have a position before God. And the Rechabites here, you can take it as, I think it's a promise to them as in a national kind of sense. God will keep them. And he's always had his people down through time. Always had his people. But in a spiritual sense, it's just a man of faith. It represents this people. Those who will be people of faith. It doesn't matter whether they're blood lineage or not. If they're people of faith, you shall not lack for a man to stand before me. That kind of a people.
Know if they were preserved at all as a people?
I don't have any information on it, no. So, I have no doubt that they were, though.
Why did Jonadab command that they...
I don't know. It may have been a vow, a holiness kind of vow. You know, it's kind of part of a Nazaritic vow, but it's not really a Nazarite. It was something he set up, and he apparently did it as a thing, you know, kind of a holiness thing. Because at the time, they weren't very holy. You know, under Jehu, they were not holy at all. Jehu did go and remove the Baal worship, but he himself was not righteous. So, you know, he did that because he did it out of an outward desire to fulfill the word of God and to please God in that sense. But his heart wasn't turned toward God. That's what we see about him. It's a really interesting situation. There are people that do righteous things for wrong motives. But they do righteous things anyway. Well, God will honor that in one sense, but, I mean, for the individual, they've got to have that heart relationship. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. The righteous things don't mean a thing. There are a lot of people that do righteous things, and this is what you'll run into when you go out witnessing. Oh, I met a Christian. He acted like this and this. Hey, I know this Buddhist down the street. He's really, you know, he's always good. He's really kind. He's always, you know, doing this and he's always doing that for me. I mean, so what good is Christianity? I say, well, you missed the whole point. They're not perfect, they're forgiven. And that man is not forgiven or perfect. So, you'll hear that sometimes, though. Chapter 36. And it came to pass in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, that this word came unto Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Take thee a roll of a book, and write therein all the words that I have spoken unto thee against Israel, and against Judah, and against all the nations, from the day I spake unto thee, from the days of Josiah, even unto this day. Now this roll of a book is a parchment roll. Okay? Verse 3, It may be that the house of Judah will hear all the evil which I purpose to do unto them, that they may return, every man from his evil way, and that I may forgive their iniquity and their sin. Verse 4, Then Jeremiah called Baruch the son of Neriah, and Baruch wrote from the mouth of Jeremiah all the words of the Lord which he had spoken unto him upon a roll of a book. Now you see in verse 3 that he's still giving them a chance. Write it down, and maybe they'll hear it. In other words, it's going to be read, as we'll see, it's going to be read. Maybe they'll hear, maybe they'll turn. He's spoken it before the people, but let's give him another chance. Now the word Baruch here in verse 4 means blessed. Blessed. And Neriah is the light of Yahweh. So he's the blessed light of Yahweh. He is the helper of Jeremiah. He's Jeremiah's helper. The blessed light of Yahweh. Verse 5, And Jeremiah commanded Baruch, saying, I am shut up. I cannot go into the house of the Lord. Now this shut up is probably not prison. Verse 19 shows him to be free in this chapter, verse 19. It shows that he's probably held back by various civil commands from going to the temple. They'd gotten tired of him going in there and preaching to the people. They didn't want it anymore. The authorities probably feared Jeremiah's message. And they found a means to keep him out of the temple area and away from the people. He's dangerous, you know. Dangerous man. Keep him away from the people. They might repent, you know. Where would our power be then? That's why the Sadducees conspired to kill Jesus too. Afraid of losing their position. They said, you know, the Romans will catch wind of this and it'll cause an uprising and they'll come and they'll take our power away from us. That's why. Verse 6, Therefore, go thou and read in the roll which thou hast written from my mouth the words of the Lord in the ears of the people in the Lord's house upon the fasting day, and also thou shalt read them in the ears of all Judah that come out of their cities. Now the fasting day is probably a special fast, and probably because of impending danger on Jerusalem. So they'll all be gathered together. Verse 10. Then read Baruch in the book the words of Jeremiah in the house of the Lord, in the chamber of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, the scribe in the higher court, at the entry of the new gate of the Lord's house, in the ears of all the people. Now this is probably from an open balcony that overlooked the courtyard. So he's got quite a commanding view, and he's reading it, and they're going to listen now. When Micaiah, the son of Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, had heard out of the book all the words of the Lord, then he went down into the king's house, into the scribe's chamber, and lo, all the princes sat there. Even Elishama, the scribe, and Deliah, the son of Shemaiah, and Elnathan, the son of Achbor, and Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, and Zedekiah, the son of Hananiah, and all the princes. Now I want you all to go home and practice all these names. Then Micaiah declared unto them all the words that he had heard when Baruch read the book in the ears of the people. Therefore all the princes sent Jehudi, the son of Nethaniah, the son of Shelemiah, the son of Cushi, unto Baruch, saying, Take in thine hand the roll wherein thou hast read in the ears of the people, and come. So Baruch, the son of Neriah, took the roll in his hand, and came unto them. And they said unto him, Sit down now, and read it in our ears. So Baruch read it in their ears. Now he read it, the people heard it. They took it back to the princes. The princes heard it. They said, we've got to hear the whole thing here, because they only heard a little portion, you know. He couldn't remember everything that had been said. So they wanted to hear the whole thing from his mouth. So he came to the princes now, and he's going to read it to the princes. Now it came to pass when they had heard all the words that they were afraid, both one and another, and said unto Baruch, we will surely tell the king of all these words. Now they were afraid. There was some fear of God still in them. And they're going to tell the king. Not as a threat, but as part of their duty. See, they wanted the nation saved. And so they were concerned that the nation wouldn't be saved. But as we shall see, Jehoiakim would not hear. And we'll continue tomorrow.
This all last week. I'm probably going to stay that day.
Take a couple days to do it.
I don't know.